Hello and welcome to recording number 13 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated recording. Today is September 13th, 2021. So yesterday we were back with Obmi, always unpleasant, and got something here that I was very confused with. Obmi has set up a Claddra, or at least who he thinks is a Claddra, and her party to be raided by bandits. I'm not really sure how that doesn't break his supposed rules of not interfering with the other contestant or hiring somebody to attack them. But beside that, it's actually the attack itself. Omni has sent one of his followers, Bolt, a sorcerer, to go with these bandits. Now, when he's talking to Bolt, I believe he is... He is in La Pala, or Hlupalu. And we know that this group gets attacked... when, at least as far, maybe I'm mistaken here, but the gourd passes down through all and is down in the lower desert area, and I believed he was, after he's captured by the Aradin, he was being sent to Carnoush. So he's actually several days ride away from, you know, where this is. So somehow, Bolt gets down there, he joins the bandits, and there's no mention of him with the Aradin. They ambush the train, they supposedly kill the elf who was in the train, and then he's back by the next night in La Pala. And I just can't see how it was done. And maybe he actually ambushed the real Claddra. I don't know. But so we're right there, and Bolt has just told Obmi about all this. So we're going to restart on page 141, the last paragraph. Obmi and his group left Hlupalu the next day, then spent the next 12 days on a somewhat leisurely journey southwest from Hlupalu to Gastor, generally following the edge of the grasslands where they bordered the Penors and the Bering Mountains. The travelers were not molested or even appreciably delayed along the way for three main reasons. Oh, jeez. All right, guys, can anybody hear me? Anyone hear me? All right. Well, we'll see if we can maybe cut that out, but it's not a big deal. I'll restart this paragraph. Obmi and his group left Hlupalu the next day, then spent the next 12 days on a somewhat leisurely journey southwest from Hlupalu to Gastor, generally following the edge of the grasslands where they bordered the Penors and the Bering Mountains. The travelers were not molested or even appreciably delayed along the way for three main reasons. First, the group was small and unimposing enough so that no troops of nomads or bandits would expect to get any real spoils from a raid. Second, as Bolt had alluded to in his recounting of the earlier events near Hlupalu, it was rare that a band of western tribesmen would assault a small group of foreigners, although all the nomad tribes shared disdain for easterners, their real quarrels were with and against each other. And third, on the three occasions when a smattering of scavenging tribesmen did threaten to approach Obmi and the half-dozen who accompanied him, all it took was show of force from Bolt to kill or maim one or two of the raiders from a long distance, and send the survivors away, cursing, scurrying back the way they had come. The nomads of the West were not ignorant of magic, but few of them had any experience with Diomers of the sort that Bolt could call up. Out of the corner of his eye, Abmi noticed Bolt take a seat at his table, and he vaguely heard what the man said to him. But the main thrust of his thoughts were elsewhere. His reminiscing had come full circle, back to the conversation he had had earlier this day with the Warlock messenger. Now he muttered to himself, "There is no second Ecclavdra, no clone. Someone seeks to give me false information to slow and confuse me. Perhaps a clone might be growing. It will be weeks too late." "You spoke, Lord." Abmi turned and glanced at Bolt. The dwarf was angry at being overheard. He had not meant to speak aloud. "No, I merely allowed my tongue to move in conjunction with my thoughts." "If you heard anything, forget it." "There is nothing to forget, Lord. I only heard the sound, not the sense of what you uttered." "That had better be so, or I will separate your ears from your head. So why are you here?" Bolt bowed his head only slightly, trying not to be intimidated. After all, he told himself, this despicable creature needs me far more than I need him. "Preparations are nearing completion," he said, lightly repeating his earlier statement. "I have attained our supplies, plus the documents and plans needed for the vehicle. And now I have come to ask you when you will be ready to depart." "Good," grunted Abmi. "Now find a secure train, a caravan of size and protection, sufficient to deter attack from the swarming bandits who litter the way between here and Carnoush. We will be heavily laden for this part of the journey. So there is no sense in trying to go alone. The leisurely pace of such a caravan will gull our enemies. They will never suppose we would travel thus." "I have taken the liberty to investigate departures, Lord. And a caravan such as you desire is assembling even now." "It is scheduled to depart in 2 days, Bolt told the dwarf. "How many will there be?" "3 squadrons of guards, 90 warriors all told. They will cover the front, flanks, and rear of a train of 200 camels, half as many horses, some of those odd carts favored by the locals, and several hundred handlers, drivers, and bearers." The sorcerer said as he ticked off the composition of the caravan on his fingers. "This is the main group journeying to the slave fair held annually in Carnoush. My agents relate that small bodies of slavers with their merchandise will be allowed to travel with the caravan. And known merchants who have hired fighting men to bolster the strength of the mercenaries there to protect them, main body will likewise be permitted to accompany the train. All told, 1,000 or more will be going south." Abmi could not help being startled at the size of this pilgrimage, but concealed his surprise beneath a screen of gruffness. "How many guards will there be all told?" he asked. "Probably near to 150, Lord." "All right, break. That is a very sizable caravan there. So we get some idea. Now, this caravan is part of an annual trek to Carnoush, as it is a big slave market. So we it's a little more information about the area, Carnoush, about how they're traveling. This sizable caravan, really about 10 times the size of what they didn't in what we've seen before. So, something of real note for this season in the slave trades in Carnoustie. So, you know, that in itself is a bit of lore to add to what we have here. Abmi doesn't really reveal much of anything. We hear that Bolt is either high enough level, or they're saying that there's perhaps a difference in some of the magic available in the Flaness and a magic available out here in the Baklunish lands. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 143, the second paragraph from the end. "Good," said the dwarf. "As large as it seems, that is still a paltry number, and the size of raiding nomad bands is considered. Even the most loutish of these Baklunish tradesmen must realize that. Our group of a dozen of the toughest horsemen, better certainly than twice their number of ordinary guardsmen, will be assured passage, for we have such strength as those louts cannot decline." "Most aptly put, my lord," Bolt said unctuously. "Even the 20 camels we have will be useful, for these pigs always count on losing some of their number to raiders. But we should expect that they will surely place us at the tail of the caravan, hoping that any attackers will fall upon us first." The dwarf scowled. "That is unacceptable." "Of course, lord, under most circumstances the position would be most perilous. With our men bearing Mazir banners on their lances, and the wagon drivers we have hired all displaying heavy crossbows as well, most who see this show of strength will decide to strike elsewhere in the train, if at all. Besides, my own spells will blast any who are foolish enough to attack. The whole country is not fit for a civilized dwarf to be in, let alone have to travel through," Abmi growled. "I want no fighting of any sort. It might delay my progress or make the journey even more unpleasant than it will have to be. Use more of the funds at our disposal to have your agents bribe the steppe nomads not to raid this caravan." "That is sound thinking, lord," Bolt agreed, even though he doubted that any sum of money would actually prevent the wild tribesmen from taking what they could if the pickings looked easy or rich. "Yet your words make me think of another alternative, noble dwarf. Could you not employ the gold to enable the smaller slavers to hire their own mercenaries? Another 100 warriors would be sufficient to discourage raiders from molesting us." He thought about that for a minute. "It is pleasing to me, sorcerer, that you're learning from my wisdom," he said. "Then you may use the coins as I now tell you. Select the most likely prospects among the local slave dealers, and make certain they use the money to hire guards. We will show our unswerving exactitude in adhering to the rules of the contest, because the guards are not for us, you see. Still, sorcerer, make sure that the ones in our debt know who their benefactor is. A few extra men between us and an attacker might mean the difference between life and death." The caravan departed from Gastor 3 mornings later. It was even larger than Bolt had originally described, thanks to the late addition of several dozen guards attached to various slave merchants. The whole operation of getting underway was confused and slow, of course, because of the last-minute changes and the overall size of the train. It was not until just before noon that the last of its elements rode out of the city and down the long slopes leading to the barren plains. main body was encamped and finished with the evening meal by the time Abni and the rest of the tail end arrived at the campsite, just 10 miles from their starting point. The next morning's routine went far more quickly, for all components of the caravan now knew their places and had a greater sense of urgency. Some news had reached the caravan in its first encampment, and that information caused things to tighten up immediately. Bolt, while walking through the campsite, rushed to tell the dwarf what he had learned. "Lord Abni, may I enter?" he called from outside the dwarf's silken tent. "Come in, come in. This had better be important, though. To interrupt me thus." Bolt parted the flap and ducked inside the low pavilion. Abni had a few amenities in his tent, despite a demeanor that implied he was accustomed to such things. The dwarf was hard as iron, tough as boiled leather. The sorcerer bowed and said, "Survivors of a Yolite caravan, which preceded us, have just come into the camp. They were attacked a week ago by Orodan warriors, a group of more than 500, they say. Have you learned any other details?" "I am not certain of the truth of the rest, great dwarf, but from what I understand, the Yolai had spell workers who inflicted great loss upon the raiders before they died. The survivors claim that they actually defeated the Aradan, although the Yolai fear and hate those camel riders, so they always report victories and sometimes lie. They do have several heads and trophies, as well as some loot, but such stuff can be snatched even in defeat if a rear guard manages to disengage and flee." "Incomplete information is useless, sorcerer. Go back and find out more. Whatever you learn, you keep to yourself. Report to me in the morning after we are underway." Bolt understood. "I obey, Lord. May you rest well." Then, muttering under his breath, the Doomer Crafter withdrew and set about his assignment. Although he would prefer to rest, he didn't trust anyone else in their group to gather the facts he knew Abni would demand. Besides, if he delegated the responsibilities to another, one he selected would take advantage of his knowledge to supplant Bolt in some way. So far, the sorcerer had managed to be the chief lieutenant of the group. They meant to remain in that position. If anything untoward should happen to the dwarf, then Bolt would become champion in his place. The sorcerer smiled at that thought and went about his work. Bolt rode at Abmi's side when they broke camp next morning, but did not volunteer any information. He was determined that the dwarf make the first overture, and after several minutes that was what happened. "Well, what more did you learn?" Abni growled. Satisfied to have won the Battle of Wills, the sorcerer withheld none of what he knew. "The Yolite train was smallish, my lord," he said. "It carried goods and slaves to Carnoush. The merchants, hoping to be amongst the first there, and thus gain highest prices for their wares. Knowing that they stood greater risk of attack because of their small numbers, a pair of fairly strong spellbinders, one a demon crafter, the other a priest of some sort. There is but a single merchant amongst the returning party. His goods are lost." "The Yoli did not defeat the Aradan, then," Abni said flatly. Pardon, my lord, but I suggest that perhaps the survivors speak truth for once, as unlike the back loony as that is. Frowning, the dwarf demanded to know why Bolt should thought that way he did. Because, great dwarf, the merchant made sense even as he beat himself and tore at his beard over the loss of his goods. The to travel ahead or back slowly laden with such stuff, only a handful of men, would be to invite every predatory nomad to fall upon oneself. The Yoli, even though they slaughtered great numbers of the attacking Aradan and drove them away, dared not recover their property and to try to travel with it. They came back northward. Well done, sorcerer, said Abni, his spirits abruptly unusually high. Your news is splendid, and your assessment sound. I think that is an excellent omen for us. The Aradan will be licking their wounds for a time. Oh, yes, they'll gather their warriors again, and that band will be larger and more bloodthirsty than any seen for a long time by the sons of Yol. We will be long past, however, safe in Carnoush or beyond. Tribes less fierce than the Aradan, and that is most, will hesitate to come against any caravan of any size for a while. Anyway, the story of the Aradan's defeat will spread quickly through this wasteland and will disenhearten other raiders. Our trek will be a quiet passage through a peaceful land, I'll wager. Abmi's pronouncement proved to be true. That was fortunate in a way that his optimism was not shared by most of the other travelers. The big caravan made a little more than 20 miles each day. A pace for so large a train of men and animals, drivers, merchants, and guards alike, spurred on by the thought of vengeful veiled warriors. The terrible camel-born Aradan coming down upon them by the thousands. Alright, break. So, you know, we get the idea of again, the unreliable narrator with what is going on by the Yoli talking about their attack. Now, Gord's hand is, of course, what allowed them to survive. And the few that returned, you know, it's very... They escaped only because that ring of troops was broken. And there couldn't have been much more than 100 of the Aradan, not the 500. As claimed by the Yoli. So, you know, we're seeing this pattern here of, you know, how the like, especially the Yoli are expand upon these things to make themselves look better. Still no idea quite who the Aradan is. But more about Carnoush and Lake Carnoush, which is there on both the map in this book and the map from the Darlene map and Anna's map, all show that lake there, although it has a different name. So we get a general idea here of how dangerous, you know, that is in that area there. This is, you know, a vast caravan of over what did he say? It seemed like more than 200 or so warriors, over 1,000 people in the caravan. But the final word on page 148, paragraph 1, is that they worry of the Aradan coming down upon them by the thousands. So a very We've a very large tribe. And as Chris points out, we do find out that the Aradan are amongst the fiercest of the nomad tribes. They definitely seem to be a cut above even the Paynim. I'm not sure how strong those Tazmeti tribes are, the semi-nomads that Gord had met. But we do see that the Aradan are a very strong force. Now, Gord was able to kill about a fifth or a fourth of their number by himself. But Gord is, you know, an exceptionally experienced figure. Now, in this book, we can't quite be sure that we're seeing AD&D mechanics anymore. So, you know, it's not going to be as easy to make judgments. And Gord was able to be captured and made prisoner and was not able to escape until the night of the battle. So, you know, again, it's questionable what kind of mechanics are being used right here.
We also know that the Aradan don't consider themselves Becklunish.
That's right. You know, they not only despised, they called the Yoli, as Becklunish. They do war also against the Paynim. That's what makes me wonder, who are they? Because they don't claim to be Paynim, they claim to be fighting Paynim. And they also say that they despise the Becklunish, and especially the Yoli. So, you know, that is a question then. Who are these people? And what kind of culture are the people in Carnoosh? They don't seem to be Aradan. They seem to be people who the Aradan deal with.
I mean, considering their geographic, their location, maybe their soul, I don't really know, but...
Well, I doubt their soul. I don't think that... we could find, maybe they are, but I don't think they're descendants of soul. The most interesting thing were the three of races of people from the west and south. There's three wests, three south, but only three of those are actually encountered down in Carnoosh that the Aradan describe having run into before. The Jihindi, the Benhow, I think it, and another. I'm sorry, I've skipped those. I'll have to make sure I've noted. It is very interesting here that we do have, it amazes me that people are willing to jump on the chainmail and what came out of that Dragon Annual 1 as what's in the West when Gygax in this book, of course this isn't TSR, but Gygax does relate about six different cultures around that area. And all of them sound much better than we got from Dragon Annual 1. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 148 and the second paragraph. Their route was along the more westerly of the two wide trails that ran from Gastor to the city on the shore of Lake Carnoosh. Slightly longer in distance than the easterly track, but a path that was generally parallel to a dry riverbed that ran southward from the Ulspur Tors to Lake Carnoosh. Every two or three days they came to a wadi where water could be found, either lying in pools remaining along the watercourse, or wading just a foot or two beneath the surface of the ground. Two times during the journey through the dry stepland, the caravan came upon a permanent source of water, once a true oasis, another time a well. At the well site, the oasis, and some of the other places there were fortified villages. Although the tribesmen dwelling in such spots were neither strong nor numerous, The caravan master always paid over a tribute in coins or gifts for water and whatever supplies the train needed that the villagers could spare. The local folk started out demanding exorbitant prices for dates, eggs, chickens, and all the other produce that they had. But a few rounds of hard bargaining brought prices down into the realm of the believable. The dickering was obviously the chief amusement of these tribesmen, for there was little else for them to do to enjoy themselves. The leaders of caravans through these parts quickly learned how they were expected to conduct themselves, or else they paid a high price for their obstinacy. Purposely poisoned water and tainted food were only two of the more obvious means the locals had of revenging themselves upon any who sought to take water, provisions, or lives without proper payment. Anything the village could do without could be had, but money or goods in return must exchange hands. Such was the way of these places, and no wise person expected it to be otherwise. Right, so, you know, it's interesting now. So here are these villagers. Are they of Carnoush? Or are they of the Aradan? Or are they independents? And yet, these are supposed to be small villages that, you know, and they don't seem fierce, and especially if they're resorting to such things as poisoned food or poisoned water. Now, what they obviously have some kind of link to the culture of either the probably of the Aradan. There must be some kind of a deal or kinship. All right, so Chris has pointed out that here are the names of the people at Carnoush. Now, Bamin are Payman, Yolai are from the Ulish people, the people of old. The Jahindi, Sehan, and Bahau, though, they are three of the six societies that Gygax says are both west and south of the Sul Imperium, or the Sea of Dust, actually, the remains of the Sul Imperium. And so that three of them are actually close enough that they appear in the back Lunish lands in Carnoush, or are encountered by the Aradan. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 149, and it is the first paragraph. The route to Carnoush was fairly direct, for the steppe was relatively level, and few obstacles stood in the way. The 600-mile journey was accomplished in just more than 30 days. Every veteran caravaneer was astounded at such speed, especially for so large a train. Occasionally, encounters with savage carnivores were handled with ease, for Bolt and other spellbinders in the group were well prepared for such contingencies. The small bands of steppe nomads who came near the caravan were impressed by its size and capability. They approached without threatening, talked, traded, and rode peacefully away thereafter. One experienced guardman informed Abmi that these petty warriors roaming the steppe were a sure sign that the Aradan had suffered a severe defeat. For normally, these nomads they were encountering dared not come so far north for fear of the terrible veiled warriors. About halfway along their route, the nature of the land changed. The steppes were seldom favored by precipitation, but in areas well away from the intervening mountains, the clouds did drop rain upon the land regularly. As the caravan proceeded southward, a little more than halfway to its destination, dry plains gave way to a well-watered grassland. Camels were no longer essential in this place, although they certainly could survive. They were no longer the most appropriate means of conveyance. Horses were favored by this terrain, and thus the camel riding Aradan did not venture into the prairie to raid. The threat of the veiled warriors, small as it may have been, was safely passed. Large tribes and clans of horsemen roamed the grasslands around Lake Carnoush, but many were paid tribute by the city of the same name to refrain from a molesting trade. These warriors then tended to prey upon those groups that did attack caravans. The continual warfare that resulted kept the nomadic warriors in check while distributing some of the caravan loot. That which actually reached the city to even those who protected the merchants' trains, of course. The least slight or pretended offense could send some formerly non-hostile tribe into a frenzy of raiding. When this occurred, other clans would happily take bribes and tributes to reverse their roles. Then these nomads would ride out to seek the now hostile group, being paid to do so and relishing the prospect of taking loot from those who had recently gained it by pilfering some caravan or other. Ami greatly admired this system, remarking pleasantly to Bolt on its practical and logical workings, and the sorcerer had to agree. Turrets and domes dominated the brick city of Carnoush, the walled portion of the place. The actual city was relatively small. No more than 7,000 or 8,000 souls were enclosed by the high barriers. All around the city, except on the side that abutted the shore of the big lake, were ancillary villages and towns that quadrupled or quintupled the total population of the area. Many of these smaller places were liberally dotted with caravanseries and wine shops, where traders and laborers could find housing and amusement during their brief stay. All right, so Carnoush is supposed to be a very large city, and also having a very large section near it. Now, since the terrain has now become much more hospitable, we'll probably see lots of farming and herding around this area to supply Carnoush. And, it's heavy slave trade. There's going to have to be a good supply of food as well. All right, so we've got an idea now about what Carnoush is like. And, of course, there's an entire lake out here. So the area should be much more hospitable.
I wonder how most people get to Carnoush.
I would think that it has to be on these big annual caravans if the area is so dangerous with all of the nomadic raiders. Now, we know that from the east, but we don't really have an idea what's going on in the west. Now, south of Carnoush and Lake Carnoush against the Sulhop Mountains, and they have definitely, they describe mines worked by slaves, and also people living with the mountains and raiding into the Sea of Dust to find, ruins to loot and such.
Yeah, I was wondering how many people would have come from the west. Maybe the Sahan and the Bihau are from the west?
It actually says, I believe the Sahan and the Bihau are from the south. Okay. And the Mulwar and the Jahindi and one other group are from the west. So it seems to me that there is a pseudo-Hindu indie pseudo, maybe a branch that's like the Pakistani, and that there's definitely several, there's three cultures, but very, you know, Eastern Indian here. And then the South seems to be where the pseudo-Asian, the Sahan and the Bahau, where they're located. There aren't very mentions. There is a very, there is another nation mentioned later on in Night Below, that is an Asian nation. It may be a pseudo-Japan. I know a lot of people really, you know, they want to try to break away. There is room for plenty of fantasy in this setting. But yes, a lot of it, Gygax really intended on having our world parallels to provide a very easy background for DMs to use, so that you could use movies and TV and popular literature as well as historical sources to fill out your campaign. But it's always open to the fantastic, and it does not need to be a equivalent or a parallel to our world, not in any way. But Gygax definitely did use that, and I personally favor it. I like this parallel real world campaign, but I also include plenty of the fantastic, the horrific, science fictiony. I like a big mix in my campaign, so you're going to find a lot of fantasy city in Greyhawk rather than just trying to make it like a medieval fantasy. You're going to find a lot of the real fantastic in the Backloonish West, so that it too is not just being cut out like, you know, a cookie cutter will cut out dough. And I don't want to just I don't think Gygax is doing that exactly, because what we're hearing is a real mishmash, very close of various cultures that wouldn't normally be in the same time and place or locale. Even with the Backloonish right here.
Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting place to adventure.
Yeah, and I don't object to having cultures related to, you know, the Near East and the Far East. I think that those are, you know, those are not only perfectly suitable, but they're very enjoyable for characters to adventure in. And they're a little further way off. So that if you take people from even Backloony, or you take Easterners from the Flaness, you're really going to come into a new world. And since it isn't detailed, it's whatever new world you want it to be. That's always true, but even following the Gygax information here, we have known nothing about these countries, so it's going to be up to the DM to flesh them out entirely. Or to find amateur stuff, you know, fan-based work, like on Cannon Fire website, where there's a lot of material, even about places further out than the Backloonish West. All right, it's page 150, and it is, I wanted to say before, we know the structure, turrets and domes. City is brick, dominated brick rather than stone. The walled portion is only about 8,000, but it's surrounded by many, many outbuildings and areas big enough to be towns in themselves. Okay, I'm going to restart. It's page 150 and the second paragraph from the end. Continual streams of merchants came to the city. Our Carnoush was a hub where purveyors from north, south, east, and west would exchange commodities. An open bazaar was always busy. Slaves, spices, animals, ivory, and a multitude of other goods were sold and traded there. The brick Casbah has sufficient troops to encourage everyone to do business peacefully, but just in case auxiliary fortress auxiliary fortresses also stood on either flank of the city, the Shah of Carnoush was very rich and very powerful. There were no strong states around this little realm, so for a century there had been no warfare troubling the place. Such peace and prosperity brought even more merchants to Carnoush, and it was a thriving cosmopolis by all measures of the whole of Eric. Now, a break right here. So from what they're talking about with a Shah and everything, we're looking at perhaps a almost like the Iranian state, and we can go back in time and look at the, you know, like the early Iranians, and perhaps get an idea of what this Carnoush's culture is like. It certainly seems to be removed from, like, Zaif and from, like, all. It's definitely not the nomads. So in itself, it seems to be like a city-state. And definitely, you know, it's a trade center for even the far west and the far south right here. All right, I'm going to restart. Yes, maybe it's a Mughal state, as Chris mentions. All right, page 150, last paragraph. Ami's attitude about the place was in conflict with all the obvious facts. "This is no real city," he observed petulantly. It was obvious that the dwarf belittled Carnoush for one simple reason. Men, not demihumans, and in particular not dwarves, dominated it. In the whole of the city there were not more than a half dozen of his own kind. In fact, there were so few of any non-human sort here that even Bolt was amazed. An Easterner like Abmi, he had been long accustomed to encountering at least a fair number of non-humans in any city or large town. Even in the western cities of Hlupalu and Gastor, he had seen enough dwarves and elves so that neither Abmi nor Bolt felt terribly out of place. But out here on the steppes, such was not the case. All right, break. So this is not only information we're getting about what's happening out here in Carnoush, which is an oddity, but we're getting that everywhere that Omni and Bolt have been previously, that they found, you know, elves and dwarves making up a reasonable size group in all the different cities of the Flaness. So it does, you know, that is a good reflection on what you should be encountering, that there should be at least a dwarven and elven community in every city. And even with Ket, we're seeing it there too. Yes, and it's a very interesting that there's a lack of demi-humans in Carnoush. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 151, second paragraph down from the top. Here there were males and females with deep brown, dusky, swarthy, tan, yellow, or reddish hues to their skin. There were short men and women, tall ones, stocky folk and lean. Some had small nostrils, noses, others beaks. They looked different from one another. With few exceptions, they were all humans. These folks lived and worked together in harmony of a sort, at least bound to each other by their common racial heritage. But they did not consider elves and dwarves or the like as their equals. So instead of desiring to linger in this exotic city as he had wanted to do in both Hlupalu and Gastor, Abmi demanded to leave Carnoush as quickly as possible. This edict placed a terrific strain on Bolt. The sorcerer had to gather more equipment and supplies, see that all was properly packed and loaded, and all the while making certain that no spy discovered what was taking place. It required 4 days for Bolt to handle all the details. But then the dwarf's group was away from Carnoush, going along the southeast track that followed the lake's edge far more than 70 miles, before splintering into 3 similar trails heading in different directions of the compass. They led their carts and wagons, horses and mules, along the smallest of the 3 paths. The center one that led south toward the town of Tashbal, and then east and south into the Grand Sul Peaks. Tashbal will provide all the rest of what we need, Abmi told Bolt smugly, even though he himself did not know the whole truth of the matter, for he was aware that the sorcerer had no knowledge of this part of the West, and Abmi had picked up some intelligence on the subject back in Carnoush. Although even most sages and savants of the Flaness could boast no great store of knowledge on the subject at hand, the sorcerer's ignorance was a tool the dwarf enjoyed using against Bolt. All right, so they're coming to the Grand Suls, which are the Sulhot Mountains that we normally know. And we're coming to this Tashbal. And I assume it looks to be pretty much where the mine that was spoken of exists. So Tashbal is probably an accompanying town or city to the mine works that are at 7. Now, we don't know if the mine is part of the same kind of culture or even under the rule of Carnoush. Or what the story is with the people who dwell in those mountains, either the Grand Sul Peaks or the Sulhot Mountains, as they're called. All right. Now, I'm going to restart, and it is page 153, and the first... Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, it's page 152. And it is the third paragraph from the beginning. Your most learned lord, Bolt replied with a touch of sourness evident in his tone. Abmi basked in the glow of this grudgingly given praise. This verge of the old Baclunish Empire, my dear Bolt, still retains some small vestiges of the once great culture lost in the invoked devastation. They are a decadent people, but interesting nonetheless, and they will understand our needs. I bow to your wisdom, Lord, the sorcerer murmured, vowing to do his best to return the favor at the first opportunity. Between 5 and 6 days later, they arrived in Tashbal, found suitable lodgings, and set about the final preparations before entering the Ashen Desert. This city was as devoid of non-humans as Carnoush had been, but here Abmi and his ilk were looked upon more as a novelty to be enjoyed than a lesser to be shunned. The dwarf actually had a good time in his sense of the term during a week of debauchery on his week of debauchery in the ancient town, but then it was time to be on his way. Bolt had spent his stay in town, acting under more of Abmi's orders, seeking out some personnel and materials. He still needed enlarging and reorganizing the train, and generally doing his utmost to see that all would go as planned. He was tired, frazzled, and near his wit's end when the day arrived for departure, but he had accomplished everything he was responsible for. The journey from Tashbal to the mountain pass that would lead them through the Grand Suls to the desolation of the old Sul lands was relatively quiet. But then, after covering a little more than 90 miles in 6 days across the grassland, and then again over dry ground, the They came to the place where the guides Bolt had hired in Tashbul would take over, leading them through the mountains. The pass was a winding, steep, and treacherous. To traverse a distance of 25 leagues, as the crow might fly, they had to go twice that far overland, following the rocky path that was the only sure route between the crags. The journey was even more difficult because of carts that were necessary to haul the equipment Abmi needed. After more than 2 weeks of climbing and carrying and stumbling through the barren rock, through the rocks, the party made its way to the place where barren rock gave way to the vast stretch of dust and ash that rolled away to the south, east, and west, as far as the keenest eye could see. All right. Most of the party turned back now. Mountain guides, of course, were not needed any longer. Likewise, the caretakers of the carts did not have to go farther, because the carts themselves had served their purpose. Before the majority of the group left to head back north, artisans assembled the stuff in the carts, and stuff that the carts had brought through the mountains. They worked day and night while Abmi brooded and paced, occasionally overseeing the work, but more often simply waiting out the delay inside his tent. At sunrise of the second day since the group had camped, Bolt came to Abmi at the end of his master's morning meal and gently led him outside. Break. All right, so the crossing of the Gradsules here turns out to be very uneventful. So we can see that for a well-equipped and powerful enough group, they should be able to cross into the Sea of Dust at this point. With very little trouble going over that mountain range. So you wonder then that there's probably been a continuous raids going on into the Ashen Desert, and the immediate area would probably be, severely disrupted and gone over, although going into any Sul ruin would be, quite an undertaking. Abmi has that where he does, he does take it in turn to be idle and complaining, yet he is still supposed to be tough as iron. He likes his debauchery and he likes his pleasures. And you can imagine that if Abmi ever became powerful, he would probably degenerate fairly quickly. If he could just live out his own pleasures without having to struggle for them. Earlier on, the G3 Abmi stats were posted along with a little lore, and it's very strange stuff. Abmi supposedly served the Giants for 25 years. So at this point, if Abmi of here is related to the Abmi of G3, they should be, then that G module stuff is in the past. And I think that may be a possibility. The Giants' adventure is not recorded down. Gygax already has the drow as commonplace. And it would seem that Abmi may be a character going, decently far back into the past as a dwarf. And as well as Ecclabdra, they both have very long lifespans. All right, so we're just about to start Obmi's expedition into the Sea of Dust. So it's 7 o'clock. I'm going to close up now. Tomorrow, I'm no longer doing Tuesday nights, so I won't be back on again till this coming Wednesday. All right, I'm going to remember to call in Craig and kick him out this time. And this will be a good night till Wednesday. Didn't type that right.